What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you are tuned in to Kinda Neat. Thank you guys for tuning in, as always. First things first, this is the only part where I advertise, and I advertise for us. And so if you are a weekly listener and you are not yet donating or pledging, whatever you want to call it, to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/kindaneat. And my suggestion is to pledge $1 per episode, just so that every time you listen, you're just giving us a buck, you know? We're down to about one podcast a month, if that, right now, so it's not going to hurt your bank account too much. The most it would ever be is $4 a month. Thank you guys that are supporting our Patreon. I see new pledges every week or every few days, and I really, really appreciate it. It helps keep the lights on and pay the rent here, so thank you so much. That said, this intro is a long time coming because I haven't done an episode in a while, and I'm warning you right now, if you're going to listen to the intro, I'm going to start crying in the middle of it, I'm sure. So if you are not feeling good today or feeling depressed and you don't want to hear somebody else sounding depressed or sad, then just fast forward till you hear the beat. But I have like really great news. I have like good news, bad news, and then I have like really fucking bad news. So I will start by saying like the reason we haven't done an episode in a while is because I've been working on some side things, and I can announce them now because they're on paper. The ink is dry, but I signed on to host a video podcast with Skullcandy. As you guys know, I've been creating music content for Skullcandy all of last year, shooting a lot of photos and interviewing some artists that I like, that some have been on the show, some haven't. And they liked what they saw with that, but then they wanted to start a podcast, and they knew that I have experience in it. So I started off just kind of like consulting them, like in the steps that they would need. And when it came to the part of like finding a host, I was going to help them find one. And they decided like, oh, you know what? Are you doing anything? You want to just do it? And I was like, yeah, I'm down. So, you know, they made me a very kind offer, and I will be hosting a video form podcast for them that will be available on YouTube, and it's going to be called You Feel Me, because their branding is Music You Can Feel. So the title of the show is You Feel Me, and I've done a couple episodes so far. They're not out yet, but they will be available, and they're great. I mean, I'm really happy to finally be able to bring a high quality video podcast to you guys, because budgeting issues had me concerned that I wouldn't be able to do it with Kinda Neat, so I've not done it with Kinda Neat, because, as you guys know, it's just me and Ben. Ben's running the boards, I'm in here doing the hosting and filming, and then he does all the post-production, and, you know, it takes a lot to produce the quality of video podcast that I would like to do, and so thankfully, they're putting in the time and effort and the budget that it takes to make a really high-quality video podcast, so it's going to be, you know, they're kind of just letting me off the leash. Like, I am doing the same interview style that you guys are used to on this show, just with more varied artists, some of which I would pick for the show, some of whom I've reached out to on the show and haven't gotten to interview, and other artists that I wouldn't necessarily pick to be on our show, but that turn out to be amazing people as well. And so I'm really excited for this year. I'll be traveling a lot with them. Which brings me to the bad news, like the semi-bad news, is that I don't know how much Kinda Neat we're going to be doing this year, just because Ben and I are both so busy. So to make our schedules sync lately has been, you know, it's been hectic. But that said, we're always, whenever we have downtime, we're always going to try to do an episode, which is what we're doing today, because this one was something I've been meaning to do for a long time. So here comes the really bad news. You guys know that for the last couple of years, I've had a dog because I've been with my girlfriend, soon-to-be fiance, for, you know, a little over 2 years now. And she had a dog named Kennedy since Kennedy was a puppy. She got Kennedy when she was 8 weeks old, and she just turned 8 in February. And last week, a week ago from today, Kennedy got out of the house chasing a cat that lived across the street. And Kennedy got hit by a car while she was crossing the street. And, you know, she died instantly. Fortunately, she didn't suffer at all, but unfortunately, Kennedy is no longer with us. And I know that I sound like a, you know, blubbering baby right now, but all of you guys know what it's like to lose a pet. And, she, you know, she really meant the world to me. She brought a lot of organization and routine and comfort into my life. And, you know, obviously Mia has changed my life significantly for the better. And Kennedy was also a big part of that. You know, Kennedy, I didn't realize that my life was missing a dog, but it really was. And being with her the last 2 years was really great for me. And I'm going to miss her. She's a really good dog. Bring her to episodes. She was just here for our last episode. You could hear her bark in the background of the Hunna episode, you know? So, yeah, Kennedy died, and I'm really fucking sad. We're really beat up about it. We got her cremated on Thursday, and, man, it is really hard. But, like anything else, every day gets a little easier. We're getting through it. So I leave for Australia in about 10 days or 10 days. And out there, we're going to, you know, just get our minds off of it. And we have a 10-day vacation. And when I get back, I'm sure we'll go on the hunt for a new dog. You know, that's the thing. Kennedy, if you've been paying attention, I'm sure I sound like a fucking terrible dog owner because we just adopted a dog and ended up taking it back. And then fucking our dog, it gets hit by a car crossing the street, and it was just like this one bad millisecond of timing. And I wasn't even there. I was in Denver, so I had to hear about it while I was on a photo shoot at lunch, made a fucking scene in front of everybody. So I'm like, fuck, a fucking dog just died right in the middle of lunch. And then there's a bunch of people that on the shoot that I hadn't even met yet who were just like, oh, man, you know, so sorry. But yeah, you know, Kennedy, one thing about her is she had a really, really strong prey drive. She was had a very strong prey instinct that was impossible to thwart. If she saw a squirrel or a cat, she was trying to book it and chase it. And on camping and camping trips and shit like that, like I would always have to keep her tied up or on a leash because if she saw a squirrel, she's gone, you know. At the house, she's generally really good about staying in the yard. And, you know, we tried our hardest to always keep her in check at the house. And, you know, there are a few times where even while I was there keeping the most watchful of eyes, if one of the doors was cracked open, she would sit out in front of the window all day and wait for her opportunity to run across the street. And our street is not busy at all. Like, our street is very – it's a very quiet street, I would say, on average, maybe fucking 15 cars drive by all day, you know. On my watch, she's run across the street and chased that cat, you know, multiple times. And I whistle and she comes right back over after she realizes, like, oh, I don't know what to do with a cat anyway. So, you know, she goes and chases it and then runs back across the street. And, you know, every other time I've been lucky enough that no one was driving by. And, you know, unfortunately, she got out, chased that cat just at the wrong moment and didn't get back up. So it's fucking really hard. It sucks. So my life changed that way. You know, Mia has a really good outlook on it, though, and she's been trying to look for purpose, as humans do. Humans are constantly trying to look for meaning in everything, even though life is, you know, perhaps we're going to find out it's all meaningless. She had a very poignant thought process in that, like, you know, Kennedy came into her life during a trying time, and she's been – Kennedy's been with her for the last 8 years, which encapsulated most of her 20s and into her early 30s. And, you know, she went through some really hard times with that dog, and – she said, you know, maybe Kennedy was like a guardian angel of sorts. And when she realized that, you know, Mia's in good hands now and that I'm going to be, you know, helping out with everything for the rest of her life, that perhaps Kennedy's spirit knew that Mia didn't need her anymore. And even as ridiculous and superstitious as that might sound, we've both taken a lot of comfort in that. You know, and even telling my mom that story, she was kind of like, I never really would have thought of that, but that's like so beautiful. And she started like reminiscing about her last dog before her current dog. And she's like, you know, we had Odin, who was a black lab, who was a good dog. He was a black lab who like never really grew out of his puppy phase, I feel like. He was 9. And it was right after my dad had gotten diagnosed, like about a year after my dad had gotten diagnosed with Alzheimer's. He just had a seizure one day, just out of the blue, had a seizure, first time ever having a seizure. And my dad was still cognizant enough to like call my mom and be like, yo, something's wrong with Odin. Like he had a seizure today and it was really weird. And my mom was like, okay, we'll just keep an eye on him, you know? And he did for the rest of the day and it was fine. But then this was even when my dad was still working, because even when he got diagnosed, he still worked for like another year after that, because it was pretty minor. And he went downstairs to go to sleep because he had to work a night shift that night. And when my mom got home, Odin was just laying at the top of these stairs by this entrance from the garage, and was just laying there peacefully like he always did. But it turns out that he had passed like while my dad was downstairs asleep. And my mom obviously was beside herself. I remember that phone call. She was, you know, sobbing into the phone as she told me that Odin died. And I started crying as well because, you know, dogs are way better than humans. And it was terrible and meaningless at the time, but now that she looks back, she didn't want another dog, and she was like, nope, I'm done. You know, I got to take care of Barry. I can't take care of Barry and a dog. And then, you know, she told the neurologist the story at the time, and the neurologist said, well, you know, Karen, it sounds like Barry really loved being around this dog, and that dog helped keep him on schedule because it gave him a routine to stick with, you know, taking the dog out, the dog sleeping with him, comforting him, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it seems like Barry would benefit from having a dog in his life and continuing to have that routine in his life, right? So, lo and behold, my mom and my brother start looking for a dog. And the way they ended up with the dog Doc up there right now, they named him Doc because he's meant to be like my dad's doctor. They started looking at various shelters and stuff, and then it turns out that this lady who rescues dogs that my brother knew just knew that they were on the hunt, and she said, you know what? I found this dog up on an island outside of Nome, and it's a sled dog mix who was the runt of a litter of sled dogs, and he's in a shelter, but I brought him back to Fairbanks, and I'm telling you, I think this is the one. And that dog went on to become the best dog that my family has ever had. Like, we've had a lot of dogs in my years. I was born with three dogs in the family already, and then any time a dog died, we always got a new dog. And Doc is a fucking amazing dog, and he was, like, really – he really was Barry's caregiver for a long time, because before my mom retired, it was just Barry and Doc at the house, you know? And I really think that dog helped with the process quite a bit. And even when my dad stopped liking the dog to, like, sit on his lap, or when it would come up, you know, to get pet or whatever, he would shoo him away and get out of here type thing. Like, he started getting annoyed with dogs after a certain point when he stopped understanding things. And even then, Doc was so protective of him. So, you know, in hindsight, my mom looks at it as, like, maybe Odin was saying he's not cut out for this and that you guys should find another dog. And again, as superstitious as that sounds, that's how it worked out. So, you know, we're going to find a new dog. I'm going to miss Kennedy very much. All right, on to happier things. I am going to be very busy this year, like I said. So life has a strange way of evening itself out. You know, you can never get too much good news before some really terrible shit happens. That's just a reality. Life balances itself out. Somebody tweeted at me and said, oh, man, I could really use like a life sucks, but everything's going to be okay rant from Intuition. So there you go. You're getting one, because that's what happened. You know, I got some great news that I got a really generous and nice contract and a lot of work this year, only to fucking have my dog die. So yeah, things are good, but things are shitty as always. That is the moral of the story. Today on the show, we have the Epic Beard Men, who are B. Dolan and Sage Francis. And I feel like, in a sense, I don't know, I feel like a kindred spiritness with these guys, or I feel like kindred spirits with these fellas. Like, Sage was one of my, he wasn't my early rap idol, that's misplaced, like, because my early rap idols are obviously from, like, the early 90s, but at a time where I was like, oh, could I rap? Could I be a rapper? People like Sage helped it make sense for me. They showed me a business model that could work. They showed me that, you know, at that time, you didn't have to just look like Eminem or sound like Eminem to be a white rapper. Like, you could survive and carve a niche for yourself and do it with a certain amount of class and reverence for rap music without just being a total, like, leech for the culture. I don't know if any of that really makes sense, but basically I think that, like, Sage has always been respectful to those who came before him, and he was a wild man in the early 2000s, and it really spoke to me. His music spoke to me at the time, and it meant a lot to me. And so I've always wanted to have a conversation with him, and he and B. Dolan have been obviously working together for a long time and touring together for a long time, but they're finally putting out a group effort called Epic Beard Men. I think you guys should check it out. They're on tour. They're touring it. I like B. Dolan quite a bit as well. Follow him on Twitter. Really great fella. Good head on his shoulders. And I would imagine that after talking to them, you guys will see, like, we all kind of seem to have a similar outlook on all this stuff. And it was a pleasant conversation. I was really happy with how it went. So without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Sage Francis and B. Dolan, the Epic Beard Men.
Thank you.
Hi, boys.
What up?
Nice to see you guys.
I see you.
Here we are.
I feel like I'm looking at a funhouse mirror of myself or something, you know?
We are epic people who happen to be men with beards.
Yeah, exactly.
And also shiny heads.
Lots of shiny heads, lots of beards. We got two epic beard men and one normal beard man. So
I'm the normal one.
You guys are on tour right now, yes?
Yeah.
You guys kind of live on the road, huh?
We have been.
Yeah.
We wanted to... We took a little bit of a break because we had to... nail down the songs we were recording, and we needed a lot of time for that.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we go on the road, in my head, as I'm booking hotel rooms night to night on Expedia, I'm like, oh man, we'll be able to be there for 4 hours. We'll definitely write a song.
We could knock out a song.
Nah, like we get there and like he starts watching Jesus and
yo,
Miro.
Shout out. Hey, the brand is Brolic, baby. Hey, I fucking love Jesus and Miro.
Yeah.
And then I get caught up in it because I'm like looking to the side, like eyeing it, like,
yeah.
I want to be doing that too.
Yeah. Those guys are the truth. That's the best platform on the internet, man.
Yeah.
I want to preface this to Epic Beardmen fans that, like, I'm not an obsessive fan like some of you guys probably are, so I don't know if I'm going to ask the wrong questions. I know, like, when people have hardcore long-term followings, they get really mad when you, like, don't ask the right questions. But I'm just going to, like, learn about you guys. Like, we're just, you know.
That's good because we're brand new. Honestly, we just put out our first EP. Of course, we sprinkled a couple videos over the years, but it was never a real thing until now.
Right.
And people are just finding out about it. They're coming to these shows not even knowing what Epic Beardmen is.
Oh, really?
So they're, like, expecting a Sage set and a B set.
Yeah.
But it's not that.
But that's the thing is that you guys have been working together and touring together for ages now, yeah?
Yeah. 10 years.
10 years. How did you guys meet initially?
I had just moved back to Providence from New York in 2002.
Yeah.
And I was, long story short, very, like, after messing with Def Jam in New York, 9/11, crazy time down there, get back to Providence. Someone told me, look up Sage Francis. He's the only poet worth knowing about in Providence.
Right.
And I was trying Bob Holman.
Yeah, man. Shout out to Bob Holman.
Yeah.
He's in with the out crowd.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, so he told me to look Sage up. I hit Sage up about this program involving like going into.
He wanted me to work with kids.
Going into high schools. We were going into high schools performing.
He's got a good heart.
Yeah, I'm a nice guy.
Yeah, I'm not.
And he blew me off. That's what happened.
Sounds like the Sage that I'm familiar with from early 2000s.
If you bring me into a high school, I'm just going to swear in front of the teachers and do all the shit I wanted to do when I was in school.
Right.
You know, good luck, man.
I, that was an honest reaction, though, because I had been through that. I had attended schools to perform, and then I found I couldn't refrain from being very vulgar.
It's hard to edit your art.
But it was over the top. It was like I couldn't stop myself from just being as offensive as possible because I have all these deep-seated issues from my own high school experience in school. My school was super strict.
Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't even let me rap in the talent show. It's like rap wasn't real.
Was Catholic school or what?
No. Well, it might as well have been.
Yeah.
But I live in a very small, lily white conservative town, and so he asked me to do that, and I said nah.
He blew me off. I was like, this guy's not taking me seriously.
Yeah,
who the fuck does he think he is? So
I run a message board, by the way.
I used to be on that message board.
I got it archived. It's not online anymore, and everyone's like happy that people can't research what they said in 2000 whatever,
but you have it.
I'm gonna turn it into a book.
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of my true confessions is I was like a fucking Sage Francis stan from like 2000-ish to 2005, 4, 5, something like that. Like, I was on the boards. You're one of the first shows that I ever opened for. I don't know if you know that.
Wait, where?
In Santa Barbara. So my first show I ever opened for was Paul Barman, right?
Yeah.
And then about 2 months later, I opened for you. And I did all the right mistakes that opening acts make, that like I went over my time and like tried to like...
Did you make them say hop after you say hip?
I didn't do that, but I definitely like told... my crowd banter was embarrassing and terrible.
Yo,
like,
we're on new levels of crowd banter in 2018.
There's crazy shit. We've had some local openers on this tour, and we have seen local opener shit on this run specifically that we've never seen
like
before.
Like what?
And it's common from city to city. Yeah. It's not just one area of the country. It's the whole country.
Yeah.
These motherfuckers are half banter, half music.
Yeah.
Everyone starts with banter now.
Yeah.
Everyone starts with like 3 minutes of shitty banter before they even play a song.
Yeah, and they're giving, like, it's not behind the music, fool. Like, play your
exactly.
fucking song.
Well, so I think that's the problem that a lot of opening acts have. Like, when you're opening for somebody that you really look up for, you feel like, I want to explain why this song should be important to you. Like, their music is important to all of us, you know? And you think that's going to break through, but it makes everybody be like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
So,
funny.
Yeah.
And there's certain stuff, like, using the headliner's name to get applause. Like, exactly. who's ready for B. Dolan?
Yeah, exactly.
Who's ready for Sage Francis?
All right, well, you got a half hour till they come out. So,
milking it.
Yeah, yeah, like, and if it doesn't work, like, oh, I guess you don't want to see B. Dolan and Sage Francis then.
Exactly.
Like, that's normal. But on this tour, we had a band that changed genres every song.
No.
Like, they were a hardcore band.
Yeah.
Then they were rapping.
Yeah.
Then they were singing doo-wop. Like, they were changing genres. Yeah. They had as much instrumentation on stage as Radiohead.
Yeah.
They looked to be about 14 years old. This was in Pomona.
Hey, yeah. Shout out Pomona.
That was crazy.
The show that I opened for you in 2004 was like, it went me, and then I think it was either like Revolution or Iration, because they were just starting in Santa Barbara as well, mm-hmm. and the promoter like fucked with white reggae. So I think it went from like white rapper to white reggae to white rapper.
Yeah.
So yeah, fun times.
You can't test me, man.
Yeah. Trust the Fundians. I think I learned that term from you.
That's it.
Well, did you guys ever run into each other as kids?
No. Well, I'm a bit older than he is.
Yeah.
So even in the school system, we would not have even crossed paths.
Well, so how have you guys' lives been similar in your upbringing, and how were they different in upbringing now that you guys know each other really well? Like, what was it like in Providence versus North Smithfield?
Well, I wasn't in Providence. I was in Smithfield.
Oh, you were in Smithfield?
Yeah,
as well.
Well, we grew up like probably 10, 15 minutes away from
each
other.
Oh, no shit. What a small world.
Yeah. And what's also odd is that we both, at separate times, went to New York because our favorite rappers all came from New York, and we were like, all right, go to New York and rap, and then came back, which is where we met. But yeah, so that right there was like some weird like parallel track.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that we both hate but brought us together was the poetry scene.
Totally.
Yeah. Because by that point, when he had moved back to Rhode Island, I was already transitioning out of the whole slam community thing. It just, you know, it had its day. I just wasn't trying to do it anymore. But
And I was too.
Yeah. He stepped in. He was – because he came from the New Eurekan scene, which had different rules and how things go on stage. And here he is in our little like Rhode Island poetry night, breaking every rule on stage. Like, homie, you're great, but like, we're supposed to like go to the nationals, man, and you're gonna break all the rules and we're gonna lose.
Well, they never at the New York, and they never enforced the time limit. So they every Wednesday night was like a open mic for anyone.
Yeah.
And if you won on Wednesday, then you come back on Friday. And I didn't even give a shit about the competition. Someone just told me like, oh, go there. Like, I was at a poetry reading at a college, and they heard like rhymes in that were poetry, and they were like, oh, you sound like you should read at the New Eurekan. So I went there. I heard it was like harsh, but I didn't understand why.
Yeah. Tell people a little bit about the New Eurekan, because I think in the early 2000s, that was legendary. Like, we would hear about it on message boards and stuff,
right.
But I don't really know what it is. Is it similar to kind of what was happening with like Project Blowed out here or no?
No, it's just, well, yeah, it was a collective that started a venue.
Yeah.
But the collective itself, by the time the 2000s were around, like that was already like a generation past. Like,
okay.
It was very head rap incense.
Yeah, yeah.
But wasn't Lyricist Lounge?
Does it have anything to do with Lyricist Lounge?
I think it did.
Yeah.
It was just that became a venue. That became like a spot.
Okay.
So there were like a lot of there was like a weekly hip hop event there. There was the weekly slam there.
And what kind of people were you running into there? Anybody of note?
Yeah, well, I ran into the Def Jam cats, and that's where like I got seen on stage and invited to perform at the Rush Art Gallery.
Yeah.
And, like, they were taping the pilots at the time.
Okay.
And all that shit, which is where I like dropped out of school and was like, okay, that's it. Someone said Def Jam to me. Here we go.
Yeah,
like,
right.
And that scene was not for me.
Yeah.
And I immediately sensed that. I was like 18 at the time. And yeah, I was just being videotaped. No one would tell me what was happening with the tape. People just saying, I'm a manager, I'm a this, I'm a that.
Like, yeah.
Everyone real pretty on cocaine.
Right.
You know, like.
Yeah, yeah.
I met Natalie Portman at New Eurekan.
Bam?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only time I ever met her in person. And yeah. I was already on my full on.
Because like, that was like, that's like your thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that.
And I was like, because I had I was standing outside the New Eureka and just interviewing people at random. Mm-hmm. I had a digital recorder, and I turn and she's like right in front of me, and I was like, "What makes you such a freestyle monster?" And she just like slowly turned her head away, and that was it.
Nice. Did it ruin it for you?
Yeah, that was kind of hot. I wasn't too mad at it.
Because my thing used to be Jennifer Love Hewitt, and then I met her, and I was like, I haven't thought about her since, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, once Natalie had kids and we got married, I said, I have to stop making these shirts where I stalk her.
Yeah, it just gets creepy, right? When did you end up going to New York?
96. I had just graduated college, or my first college.
Yeah.
And
damn, fucking humble brag. Multiple.
Well,
times.
I had a junior college, it's not too much of a brag.
I thought you're like, I went back and got my PhD.
I had to go back and get my BA, but I had an associate's degree in communications, which translated into squat.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, all right, I'm gonna do this move to New York now because that's where you have to go to be a rapper. And I literally would just walk the streets and look for ciphers. That was the era.
That was the shit, yeah.
I was like, and it worked. Like, I met people that way. This was like, I would see a circle somewhere. I would walk toward it. I would fucking just, do my thing.
Yeah.
People would give me their number. We would connect later. One of the dudes I met on that, do you know who Breeze Everflowing is?
Of course. That's one of my... On the list of most slept on rappers, Breeze Everflowing.
Yeah, he's tight.
Yeah.
And he was a really nice cat.
I was just like, that's the dude from Prince of Thieves, right? I'm thinking of Breezy Bruin.
Breezy Bruin is.
Breezy Bruin.
So
but no, I know Breeze Everflowing too. Yeah. He was on a bunch of Def Jokes shit, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He just disappeared after a while. There was a lot of good stuff back then, and people could rap.
Yeah.
And just people knew how to rap.
Yeah, totally.
You don't see ciphers these days. There's a lot of reasons for that.
I mean, I used to like fucking live for even pre-YouTube, like just Google searching and looking for ciphers like that and seeing, you know, Aesop Rocks like on the corner of a street ciphering with Mr. Liff or whatever. Like, that was our shit all the way across the country, you know? We used to heavy lurk you guys, you know what I mean? Just to find this inspiration, because to see people that were coming from the outside and getting accepted was something that was very inspiring.
Yeah.
You know? So,
I could see
it. It spoke to us. Yeah.
It was coming from the college radio background, too, where I had a lot of access to the new people were on the come up.
Yeah.
And we didn't know who was black or white or Hispanic.
Exactly. That was the main thing, is like you didn't see people's pictures. So when I found out A$AP Rock was white, I was like, what the fuck? When I found out LP was white, I was like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? When I heard him on Sound Bombing 2, I was like, this guy is like, wow, this is amazing. And then I was like, what the fuck? He's a redhead? So, you know what I'm saying? Like,
gross.
Yeah. I was like, oh, man. But yeah, were you always kind of a troll back in the day?
I had fun.
Yeah.
That's how I learned how to type.
Really, like trolling?
Pretty much.
But I mean, that's the thing that struck me early in your career, is that even like your outward appearances were trolling. You know what I mean? Like, I think back of like your legendary Zalzan appearance and Scribble Jam and shit like that. You were out here like fooling the people, telling people you're a 46-year-old roadie and shit like that or whatever, you know?
Yeah, that was just fun, man.
Yeah.
And I specifically for Scribble Jam, I did that because, like you just said, we didn't know what people looked like.
Right.
And I didn't want people knowing I was Sage Francis.
Right.
Because then they'd have more
jokes.
Material on me,
yeah.
You know? So I was like, Zalzan, it's tough for people to even remember that name.
Right.
I embodied every white stereotype.
Yeah, mullet, fucking.
Yeah, just so that when they say it to me, it's just like.
You already got rebuttals and you already know.
Yeah, I wouldn't even have rebuttals. It would fall flat.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm owning it.
Right.
You can't, like, use it against me now.
Right.
Now, what are you going to say?
Right, right. The Cheddar Bob technique, you know, from 8 Mile.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's how that all came about. And, I didn't really consider it trolling. I just was having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, anytime the crowd thinks they know what's going to happen, it's ripe for that. It's not even trolling. It's just like an opportunity for performers. That's why I didn't fit too well in the Poetry Slam community, because I would just see that like game and I'd be like, oh, this would be easy to just like push a button. Like, what if this happened? Like, what if a dude, you know, like you have so many rules and it's so formatted, and battle rap is formatted.
Totally.
Hip-hop shows are formatted.
What's funny about how we met, because when we were talking about the poetry thing, we ended up on the Slam team, and we go to the Nationals together, and both of us could care less at that point. But we got to travel somewhere together, and just it was in Minneapolis that year. And I didn't even have enough poems to compete. So I literally had to write a poem the night we're like in a semifinals round or something. And
right.
That's how little of a fuck I gave about this shit. And it was like such a big deal to others. But that experience overall, I think helped shape how we moved forward with the way we work together and what we appreciate about each other's art and how we go about it. And that was as much as we dislike that scene and playing that game, it did have a role in what we are.
What was that scene like? Because you say National Poetry Slam, and that sounds like a big deal. Like, oh my God, is that like in an arena or something?
Yeah.
Is it a big deal?
The finals night is an arena.
It's got a big audience.
Yeah.
There's people who live off of it.
Yeah, right.
You know, so people will dedicate their lives to being known within this scene, and they get to sell their chapbooks and like more power to them.
Or
but
you tore a college circuit.
When Deaf Poetry Jam was a thing, were you guys like, oh, I'm going to be on this? Or was
they hit me up. They were like talking to me, and they were like, listen, now we've seen two videos from you.
Yeah.
One of them, you know, you got a beanie on and, you know, some hip hop attire. You're doing this hip hop poem. Really like it. But then we saw this other video and you got a long beard and flannel on. Yeah. And I don't know if that really fits the image we're going for.
Right.
We want the white hip hop kid.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're not going to get what you want. Right. That's all I'm going to tell you. That was it for me. And I hated on that religiously since that point.
Right.
Yeah. My encounter didn't go that way.
What was your encounter like?
It was at the Rush Arts Gallery.
Okay.
I'm performing. And they were into the fact that I had like a real crazy style. Like they saw like crazy white guy.
Yeah.
In me, and Eminem was popping at that time, so the subtle message I got was like, more of that crazy white boy shit would be excellent. And,
right.
And at the same time, like I'm like, didn't even have a place to live at that time. I'm living on people's couches and sleeping in train stations and shit. Got a bag on me, and got weed in the bag, and you know, I see all the bags got left in the back of the room. I turn around, I see this dude like messing with the straps of my bag, and I kind of like run up on him. I'm like, hey man, like, that's my bag. Is that cool there? He's like, yeah. He backs away from it. And then like I go and I sit down. And I'm so like anxious in this environment. I turn around and I look again at the dude I ran up on. And it's fucking Russell Simmons.
Russell was digging through your bag?
Yeah, I think he was looking at the straps and the construction. It was like this Army-Navy shit.
Yeah.
So he was checking out. Yeah, you know.
Inspiration for like fucking
clothing and shit.
Yeah,
he was trying to rip my shit early.
Yeah, no way. Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, so I hated the whole shit. But that was a taping for the pilot of the Deaf Poetry Jam.
Oh, okay. That's was. Wow. Yeah. Damn. So you're like the earliest of adopters.
Yeah.
You were at the pilot.
Well, And that's when I said I heard Def Jam and I dropped out of college.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it is. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense. I imagine where you guys are from, like blue collar, working class area. Like, what did you guys' parents do for work?
My dad was a truck driver.
There you go.
And my mom was a secretary.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad worked many different jobs.
Yeah.
He was a paper boy, you know, for a long time. And that's what I did. That was my first job.
Okay.
So, but he just moved on from job to job.
Yeah.
And my mom worked several jobs all at the same time. She was a bartender. She worked at a facility for mentally handicapped adults.
Yeah.
Actually, that's how my parents met, I think, or they both worked there for a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah, they worked and they vacationioned.
Yeah.
You know, somehow back then, even blue collar,
it was like
could go on vacation.
Right. Yeah. Somehow on a teacher's salary, my mom took us on vacation every year. And I'm like, damn, I haven't taken a vacation in like fucking 6 years.
It's wild.
Yeah.
I always think about it because I live in the house now that I grew up in.
Yeah.
My father had passed away in 2010. My mom, like, they got divorced earlier than that, but she moved to Florida.
Yeah.
So I've been living in this house the whole time. And I'm like, they used to have these big giant parties every weekend at my house, and like no one's been to my house since then. You know,
right,
it's
right.
Like, how did they facilitate all these things, work these jobs, raise a kid?
Yeah, like my parents always had like adult friends, and I'm like, man, I don't got no fucking adult friends. Like,
true,
I got,
they
like,
didn't
five
have the
friends.
Internet. They had to, like, if they wanted to talk to people.
Yo, that's real. Like, without
they
a
had
like,
to, like bring people to their
right.
house.
When I go home now, it's like my old like third grade friends. I'm like, you don't have anything to talk about. You're like, oh yeah, you got a fucking kid, and I see you got a new job. Okay, cool. So. What I was leading towards, like knowing that you guys come from like a working class background, like, did you feel different growing up there? Like, you guys are both clearly very, very heady people, probably were quite studious, I would imagine, or if not, you were probably studying on your own. So, like, did you feel like, I want to get out of this? I see something bigger for myself? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely like I was an alien that was born to, like, I think back now a lot on, like, my relationship with my dad and, like, what his perspective of me was.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we just, we never understood each other. You know, like, we came to an understanding of how to be together, but we were just very, very different people. And very different, you know, that's a generational thing and a geographical thing, because I was different than everybody around me growing up.
Right.
Which is why, yeah, you know, hip hop in the little fragments you'd get, or Stephen King books, or, you know, I just isolated in my room, which was also a source of tension, because they were like, what the fuck is he doing in there? Like, this fucking weird ass kid.
Right.
And my father would always be like, they tell me he's a fucking genius, you know,
right,
like at school.
Right.
Yeah, like I tested well and all that shit. And so teachers would tell them, like, yo, he's advanced. And he'd be like, this kid is dumb as shit. You know, like,
how come he never talks to me?
He can't work the lawnmower. He can't, you know, like, you know, basic, you know, like all the shit.
He doesn't close the toothpaste tube.
Right. Because the brain works in different ways.
Yeah, he was a math dude. Yeah. He built half our house.
Yeah,
like
he
did tile at night. He did, you know, like he understood geometry and numbers and all that shit. He was.
Did you rebel from that, knowing that your dad could do things with his hands? Were you like, fuck that, I never want to work with my hands?
I just never had the aptitude. Like, I just, like, I mean, I can do shit now. I'm surprised by how much I can do shit now and how much I did absorb.
Yeah.
But as a kid, it would just forever be him just like on a ladder talking to himself and me like staring at, you know, fucking grass,
right,
you know, like
right.
focusing on an anthill or some shit.
Yeah,
you know, I was a frustrating kid for him.
Like he had a sister too, so you had siblings to kind of share.
Yeah,
I think the home environment.
You're an only child.
Yeah, I grew up an only child, and I was not studious. In fact, I mean, I think I peaked in third grade or maybe second as far as how doing well in school, and then. I guess discovering hip hop and that becoming my life is like ninjas and hip hop were my fucking life. Besides magic, I got super into magic.
Oh yeah, I forgot. You were like, that was like your thing too. You were like a karate guy, right?
Yeah. So sports, I was huge. That's the only reason I got to go to college was because of sports.
No way.
I was good at football and I was aiming for a scholarship. And then once I got to college, because in high school, like I mentioned, it was a very small, almost exclusively white Catholic town.
Yeah.
And we all grew up knowing one another. It was a very small class. I graduated the class of like 100 people.
Yeah.
And we all pretty much knew each other from kindergarten until I graduated.
Same. I graduated from a class of 68.
I was super weird.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew what to make sense of me because no one listened to hip hop. They didn't know my influences. They didn't know why I was dressing the way I was. And it was just me trying to get the fuck out without being able to get out, you know?
Right.
So once I could get out, I just took it all in. I was, you know, once I got to college, I involved myself in everything I could. There was like, that's how I discovered the spoken word scene. Cause like, oh, there's an open mic. I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
It's like, I have raps. It's not poetry, but check this out.
Yeah.
And that's how it all just blossomed from that point on. So, yeah.
Did you always have this need to be seen on stage? Like, did you feel like the stage was calling you? Like,
I guess so.
Yeah.
I started when I was 12. And
doing what?
Like, on stage rapping.
Oh, yeah, because you had that on a tape, right? Like,
yeah.
On personal journals or something, you put that on there.
Yeah,
or,
well, that was me younger.
Oh, younger,
I would record myself in my room.
Oh, okay, yeah.
On a little tape recorder.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Once I was 12, that's when I presented it to people.
Yeah.
Again, not the community who cared about rap. So it was like, I just was, I guess, doing it for myself. And like, you know, I want to be Run DMC. So
that's so interesting. I mean, sorry, not to make this about me for a moment,
cool.
But that was one of the things that really drew me to like your whole persona when I was younger, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, because I would hear on shit like that when you had these tapes of yourself. I'm from Alaska, and like, you know, I actually went to a school that was pretty heavily influenced by rap music because it was a military base, so it was pretty diverse. So I got to pick up on a lot of things that I wouldn't have otherwise. Like, that said, by the time I was 11, I was like recording raps and putting them in citywide competitions to try and win Wendy's Happy Meals about like, please don't smoke, it ain't no joke. You know, like, we were like,
that was my first paycheck, by the way. like doing a rap for the no smoking.
That was a huge thing. They used to have rap competitions about like who can turn in the best rap about not smoking, you know? Yeah. But yeah, so I was like, oh, there's like other weird white dudes like me that like were obsessed and like wanted to be involved but didn't have a way because you're from like borderline rural communities, you know what I'm saying? So
it gives you a jaded edge too, I think, because a lot of people did experience that and they always – it's such a – You feel all alone for so long.
Yeah.
Then when other people try to act
like this is my shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Get away from me.
I see it often.
Yo, there's a big aversion of like, I mean, I'm sure you felt it for a long time. Like you meet another like white dude that has a similar story to you and you're like, man, fuck that guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because yeah, it feels like you're used to being the only dude in that. Or like,
it's a weird pride.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
It's an MC Search problem.
Totally.
There's only two human stories. Someone said that. I read that quote the other day. There's like only two human stories.
What are they?
I don't know, but I'm going to learn them.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like mine and yours. Yeah.
I've been
black and white.
I've been studying psychic readings.
Yeah,
and it's a big part of it. You know.
Yeah, I saw. Did you see? There's a $20 special next door.
Yeah,
next
called intuition. Yeah, psychic intuition.
Really?
Yeah,
it's bullshit. You don't charge for your gift.
There
That's
you
all
go.
I'm going to say.
Oh, shout out to Spotify.
Do you have a scar on your left knee?
No.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
There's no scar on your left leg or your left knee?
No. I mean, I know. I get the trick, like this power of suggestion. Like, I'm sensing somebody with a K.
Wait, you're going to give away tricks now?
Wait, I don't know.
The big tattoo and the big scar I'm looking at on your left knee?
That's not a knee. That's a shin.
Hold up. On your knee.
You're not a biologist.
On your knee, there's a scar, though.
Where?
That's just a lot of hair.
Yeah, you
got the hairiest knee I've ever seen.
He's got a big scar.
How do you wear pants and still have hair on your legs? Like, my pants rub all my hair off.
Hey, I got strong Italian genetics, baby. Like, I'm covered. You know, that ain't going nowhere.
Full-blooded Italian?
No, I'm actually only a quarter. I'm like, and then my mom is Italian-Hungarian. Okay. Yeah, what are you? We look like we could be cousins.
Yeah, I'm half Italian.
Yeah, so my mom was half and half, and so that made me a quarter. So there you go. But that's the only side of my family that I grew up with. So, like,
same.
I act like I'm a fucking, you know, paisan.
Yeah. Right.
So anyhow, all right. So...
You'd fit in really well in Rhode Island.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You know, Mark, the guy that I make music with, Equilibrium, he's from Connecticut. He's from Milford.
Wow.
Oh, word. That's super close.
Yeah, I didn't know he was from Connecticut.
Yeah, he's from Connecticut. He moved out to Santa Barbara. That's the thing is, like, he and I have a weird story where, like, we're both from these small towns and we ended up moving to Santa Barbara, which is like a weird small town in California. And we met that way because some guy at a record store was like, oh, you rap? Oh, this guy that moved from Connecticut last month, he makes beats. You guys should work together. And now 15 years later, you know, here we are.
He used to slay the remix contest on the message board.
A killer. I mean, there were certain groups that I think started having remix contests just so that he would do a remix for them. You know what I mean? He's really great at that.
It's awesome.
So you go off to college and you guys both go off to college in New York. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was in Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
And then I went to New York after that.
I only stayed in college for a year.
A year, and then you dropped out.
Yeah. I just took all the drugs available.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I hated every drug available, and I got very involved with the straight edge scene.
Right. I remember
the hardcore.
Here's what I actually wanted to get at with you guys. Being from, like, probably a pretty conservative area, I know both of you guys are very outspoken liberals for as long as I've known about your art. So what was that challenge like in growing up in such a conservative environment and having, like, a more kind of, I don't know, left-leaning, open-minded stance about things? And is your father still alive?
No, he died.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry that both of you guys' fathers died.
Yeah. Same year. We're
same
on tour.
Year,
we're
same year.
Yeah, it
on
was a
tour?
Hell of a year.
That's fucking devastating.
2010.
Man.
That was. Yeah.
Man. Bad.
Yeah, my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer right as we were about to start 6 months of touring.
Oh, fuck.
And yeah, it was adamant, like, you know, you're going on the tour. Don't even think about staying here. Like, it's all good. And then, so we were on tour, like, doing that every night, Skype sessions with test results and then get on stage. And then in the midst of that, as everybody is helping me through that, his dad passed suddenly.
Just suddenly,
suddenly.
It was crazy,
Heart thing or what?
We don't even know. There was no...
No way.
I didn't even get an official report. He was sent to the emergency room. He had a lot of health issues. He was a large man and he had like brain cancer early on, but they got the shit out, but not all of it. And he was always on medication. And it was just that whole year because Idea passed away that year too.
Right.
So I was like, he flew home. I flew to Australia to continue the tour. It was ending, but that was where we were ending it.
Yeah, this is at the end of that year.
Yeah, so right when he got back is when his father passed away, right?
It was October, yeah.
Yeah, and then I woke up in the morning, I'm seeing these messages on Twitter about Idea. I'm like, what the fuck? And I was like, so far away, I was so alone. And that year I was like, fuck all this shit. Like, I'm missing out too much at home. And I made a very strong stance to be like, this is it for me. It's over. Like, I'm not touring anymore.
I remember that, yeah.
I was adamant. People always say that. But I was like, nah, gee, yeah. This shit is done. It's like, my life is fucked.
Right.
And I did take a 4-year hiatus and my depression got worse and worse and my life got worse and worse. And I was like, I need to go back on the road or else I'm going to fucking die.
Mm-hmm.
So just to get things moving again, you know, and just try to like get back some kind of activity in my life that was positive and could make money and help my business.
Yeah.
Cause I was like, I want to be able to make money without touring myself to death. Mm-hmm. But then the flip side was also bad. But now I'm...
Well, and at the same time, if you're running like essentially an internet business, which is what fucking rap is now, and you have a house that you already said you don't invite people over to, like, that's not conducive to depression. You know what I mean? That's just going to intensify.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, some of it is situational. Some of it is just natural.
Right. Absolutely.
And I didn't even deal with that properly probably until December of last year. Mm. And now I'm on the... You know, I'm better.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a lady back home who I look forward to returning to, and she makes it difficult for me to be on the road now.
Yeah.
But
you're getting all grown up.
Yeah. I'm like, I'd rather, because I know the other side of life. And
depression is a lifelong journey. And as you get older, you just figure out better coping strategies, but you never can really get past it. It's always there in the back of your mind. Have you struggled with that as well?
Anxiety is more my shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
I self medicate. With a lot of weed.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, the weed's gotten like some whole other level out here.
Really?
Like he's showing me these
dabs and everything. Yeah,
Cali's been blessing me. Yeah. Cali's been very generous.
You know, it's funny. Yeah, like this sounds so stupid, but I was like trying to get back into weed to see if it would help with my depression, and my anxiety got bigger with was like keeping me up at night a little bit and shit. So I was like, never mind. I'm better. I quit drinking 2 years ago as of May 5th, and I'm just realizing I'm just better off in my own psyche, clean, you
that's
know what
awesome.
I mean? Which is something that's dope. Difficult to figure out anyway. But
yeah,
weed helps for sure. I mean, I spent most of my early 20s like heavily self-medicated.
It just interacts well with me.
Yeah,
like,
there you go.
We get along. We do good work together.
Indicas or sativas?
Sativa.
There
always
you go.
Sativa.
Yeah, yeah.
Indica
creative.
Take me to. Although I've been even out here, cats have given me like mad sample boxes. So I've been messing with some indicas and it's not, I'm like growing.
Did you go to MedMen?
No, these dudes, I should know their name too, but they gave me...
Check out MedMen while you guys are in town. It's really crazy because everybody's trying to say, they're starting the Apple store of weed, but one's really the fucking Apple store of weed.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
I saw some pictures of it online.
It's really interesting. You walk in and there's like all these weed sommeliers and iPads everywhere and shit. It's very technology-based.
Let's get all weed offenders out of jail.
I was going to ask you guys about politics because I do appreciate both of you guys' views for a long time and very outspoken about similar issues that I am passionate about. And so when did you guys start of like educating yourselves on that matter and becoming activists like I know you guys are? Because I find that... Well, super intriguing.
You were asking about being a liberal
in a conservative area.
Yeah. Which is more of an issue now.
Yeah,
my neighbors are Trump voting
totally
intense people.
Would your dad have been?
Yeah. He was a Rush Limbaugh.
Did
listener.
You guys have to have those conversations?
Yeah, that was it was terrible.
That's kind of what I was trying to get.
Oh
at.
Yeah, we had a horrible relationship, but it wasn't even about politics. Like our horrible political relationship was like later after the physical violence had ended. You know, that was like, but that aside, my dad was very political. Like he was a political minded dude and he paid attention to politics and that probably influenced me in some way. But yeah. And I didn't identify myself as liberal ever. I just like, I heard Public Enemy and Rage Against the Machine. And Rage Against the Machine had that Evil Empire album where, like, if you open it, they had that picture of a pile of books. And I went and just found those books and started reading those books. And they made that combine, you know, like, that was one of the things that attracted me to hip hop initially was like the anger. And then, like, I identified with that anger, even though it was obviously a completely different anger, which led me to like an understanding, like, this is why shit is fucked up. This is why people are poor. This is why people are not educated. This is why ignorance, you know, is around you. Even though obviously these rappers are talking about a totally different environment, you know, there was like a class understanding that I started to get.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I moved to New York, so I really hip hop just kind of pulled me in to political activism even.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved to New York, the first protest I went to was Amadou Diallo was, you know, 41 mm-hmm. shots and all mm-hmm. that. And Mos Def was there and like, you know, spoke to the crowd and shit. And I was like on board. I was like, and at the time, all those raucous cats were like, yo, turn jams into political revolutionary part, you know, like, mm-hmm. and I was like, okay, like, this is it. I believe you. Like, and then 9/11 happened and I was looking for like, who's, you know, what now?
Mm-hmm.
And it was quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't even aware of Makeshift Patriot.
Yeah,
at
Makeshift
the time
Patriot,
until later.
That was a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my, I guess I would say my first overtly political track. Even
right.
Though it wasn't.
I still say like typical dark skinned Disney villain to describe things yeah, to this yeah. day. Cause I was like, oh, that's such a poignant way to put it. Like, that's what yeah. it is. That's what the media tries to look for.
But yeah. my household was devoid of politics.
Really?
Never spoke politics. It was not a very cultured household.
Yeah.
We watched Roseanne.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know.
Yeah, same. Like Thursday yeah, nights watched, on NBC were huge for us. Friends, yeah. Seinfeld, all
never,
that.
We never I never would even know how my parents voted because they didn't talk politics
my
in the
parents
house.
Were secretive about who they voted for, too. My mom, to this day, won't tell me who she's going to vote for
that's
because
an older,
that's how her dad raised
yeah,
her.
Yeah,
you know?
My grandma's like that, too. It's
yeah.
like, I remember being a kid. She took me to the voting booth when it was one day when she voted.
Yeah.
And she got out and I was like, who did you vote for? And she was like, you never ask that.
Right. right. That's like asking somebody's salary like, yeah. or something to them, you know?
I was like, fuck it. We don't ever talk about politics then. Okay.
Right,
but
right.
And I didn't really know what a liberal was or a conservative. I had
yeah.
no idea. That wasn't really any part of our life. I played football and did karate and rapped. And
I think to an extent growing up obsessed with rap, like I'm sure the three of us were, I think you kind of innately gain this sense of empathy for what you're listening to
yeah.
because
yeah.
you're hearing the rappers that you grow up idolizing telling these terrifying tales of like the woes of disenfranchised neighborhoods and you can't help but be like, whoa, this is fucked up.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what I mean? And like particularly as a fan of black art, it's like you want to empathize with the disenfranchised people of color in
some,
the world.
Some people.
Yeah.
I still come across people who are fans of...
Yes. This is something I want to talk to you about, so go ahead.
Because I encounter it often.
Yeah.
Not just on Twitter, but in real life at our shows where people, I would assume, are at least sympathetic to Black Lives Matter and mm-hmm. that cause, and they're not. Like, they just have a conservative mind, but they love rap.
But I actually want to talk to you guys about that because that's something. Like, I don't really plan my questions, but this is one of the few that I planned with you guys because I think that all three of us probably have encountered this where you get fans that say they like real hip hop, and I'm putting quote fingers up, but they mean white hip hop. And for guys like you who grew up on like, you know, particularly like Public Enemy, Black Power rap, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like that shit is disheartening. And to an extent, it disgusts me, but you can't like tell every, I mean, there's just not enough time in the day to like confront every person that talks to you about that shit. And I try on Twitter, believe me, I've gotten into some fucking
yeah.
Twitter fights.
It's a teachable moment though.
Yeah.
When you can
How do you guys handle that?
Well, typically, I try to always say, oh, well, you know, thanks to Public Enemy and KRS and, you know, I'll list off all the artists that inspired me. I was mm-hmm. like, if you think no one out there is saying shit,
mm-hmm.
I was like, I grew up on hip hop. Mm-hmm. How do you think I turned into me and what I do?
Mm-hmm.
So don't just say you are the only one or like,
because
I don't think they specifically target white hip hop, but they have to think about why their top five rappers are all white
mm-hmm.
because that's pretty fucking bullshit.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
like it's not just a coincidence. You know, there's something else happening that you need to figure out.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it also depends on the like the person, the approach and all that. But yeah, it is. I feel like we both have gotten good at like jujitsuing around that when it comes up because it comes up at times. I feel like it comes up less these days. But, yeah, I don't know, man. I talk about whiteness. Yeah. Like I'm like, if we're majority white in this room, and you are, you know, like, you can identify with this perspective, then like, let's talk about whiteness. So we do that sometimes. Like,
yeah. What do you, like, talk about whiteness? Like, how it's a social construct?
Yeah. Songs like Earth Movers, okay, or like, you know, they see the vision in our clear blue eyes. You know, like, if you, you know, we can make rap. And also, I just repeat over and over again, like, I think hip hop is black music. I think it comes from the history of black music in this country, and that, like, you have to acknowledge that and be respectful of that if you're going to participate in it as a white person.
Absolutely. That's like what I try to fucking shout from the bell towers. And like, we're guests in this culture and we should act accordingly. And if you, like, there's no two ways about it. Like, all of us are, to an extent, culturally appropriating. So it's like, at least fucking be respectful to the culture while you're in it, and and not try to exponentiate that appropriation by, I don't know, I look at artists like Lil Dicky, where they're like, you know, that song Save Money to me is like such a fucking dog whistle, you know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, oh, black rappers are, when they talk about buying extravagant things, that's not fiscally responsible, i.e. that's why black people are poor. Like, that to me is what conservatives want to hear. But then they go, oh, but I love rap music.
Lil Dicky's on some wild minstrel show shit.
Yeah, fuck that fool.
You well, he, you know, when you do comedy rap, you do risk becoming that minstrel character, thinking that in itself is funny, but not realizing why it's fucked up.
You're right, and the implications of it.
As a white rapper that wants to do comedy rap about race, like, your shit better be on point. Your shit better not involve Chris Brown.
Right.
Because you come from a marketing background and you're like, yo, if this, I get Chris Brown to say the N-word, but people know it's me. And then, like, then some little white girls on a college cheerleading bus are, you know, you didn't know that was going to happen? Of course you did, man.
Of course.
Like, well, those girls are going to be singing anyone's lyrics, regardless of who it is. That's another problem. Or I don't even know if it's a problem. It's just a reality in hip hop that people act like, oh, you better not be singing those lyrics. Like, yeah, everyone, if you say it in your song, every person of every race is going to be saying it in their car, trust.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Festivals and...
Which is, I mean, I'm not going to get all bent out of shape. It's, you know, it is what it is.
He's whack. He's a
but
whack
there's also
human.
These kids. It's not just, it's not even white people not being able to respect hip hop's origin and the social conditions that it came out of. But now the new generation of rappers don't even want to respect the greatest rappers of all time.
Right.
So it's like, as we move on, you have to continually recognize that people are inherently selfish and they just care about their immediate situation. And there's only going to be a special few people of every demographic that truly does the work, does the hard stuff, that makes them research, that and when you do, like any craft, any music, you will love it if you understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, similar to both of you, rap for me was something that I did study and something that opened more doors to more musical avenues for me. And because of rap, I learned so much more about the history of rock, the history of soul music. Like, I got put onto all these other artists that, like, mean the world to me because I listened to fucking Wu-Tang because I listened to KRS. You know
that's
what I mean?
One of the best things about hip-hop as a genre is that it does open you up to all those other genres. Because, like, a rock cat, like, they should learn about rhythm and blues.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, all rock and roll is based on blues Americana. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had a really frustrating conversation with an Australian cat one time who I was trying to tell him, like, all popular Western music has its roots in African American music, right? And he's like, well, surely not rock music. That's white. And I said, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I almost, like, blew a gasket, dude. I was like, and I had to explain him the whole history of fucking Chuck Berry and fucking, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Leadbelly and these guys. And he's just like, what? You know, I'm like, fucking listen
to
it.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But it's dope that you're actively listening. When you say, like, there is a thing about where you actively listened, like someone that was passionate about it, and we did too.
Yeah.
I think America in general does not listen to hip hop at all. Even if Public Enemy was the number one song on the radio, that shit would just come and go, and we would still be in these situations with Black Lives Matter and predictable shit going mm-hmm. on that like Richard Pryor has material about from the 70s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we are still reacting with shock to, as if like 30 years of rappers hadn't been telling us what was up with the police and people of color
yep.
and poor communities.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so does America like listen to rap?
Right.
It's arguable. It's questionable.
It's like the white man can't trip shit. Like, you hear it, but you don't yeah. listen to it. You listen to it, but you don't hear it. Yeah. That's a frustrating conversation for me always, because I always get those people like, oh, you know, you're the best rapper. Or this person's the best rapper. I'm like, yo, nah. Like, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. Like, the influences stack on top of each other, and you learn what you learn from the artists that you grew up idolizing, who, for me, were all black. You yeah. know, so
in fact, I wouldn't listen to white people when I was growing up. My yeah. mom bought me the Beastie Boys tape.
Yeah.
Like, please listen to a white person, because right. they were so bugged out by right. my fascination with black culture at that
yeah.
moment.
Yeah.
Like, where are you getting this from? Like, right. you know, they were so like, my grades were shitty. They wanted to always blame it on rap. And
right.
rap was the devil and whatever.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Man.
Same thing. My mom took away my fucking Doggy Style tape and my 36 Chambers
tape. I wanted
to
ask, yeah. since you're Italian, yeah. if there's racists in the family.
You know what? The first time I ever heard somebody say the N-word in yeah. real life in a negative connotation was like my 75-year-old, my mom's godmother, who we used to call my Aunt Lou. She, you know, she's passed, so she doesn't care about this. But yeah, we went back for my grandfather's funeral when I was 7 years old, and my mom's like, hey, Aunt Lou, how is everything? She goes, well, you know, everything's fine, but all the N-words are moving into the neighborhood. And I was like 7. I looked at my mom like, oh my, I'm like as soon as Aunt Lou turned back, I'm like, she just said the N-word. Like, what the fuck? She can't say that, you yeah. know? Yeah, it was, but I've noticed on the East Coast, they don't call it racism. They call it prejudice. Oh yeah, she's prejudiced. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
out
yeah.
here, we're like, oh, that's a racist.
No, yeah.
You know?
No,
I got in a prejudice argument on Facebook. That was one of my last, when I cared to argue with people on
yeah,
Facebook.
Right.
The whole difference between being prejudiced or bigoted and
right.
like, stuff like, all right, fuck all you guys then.
Oh God. Facebook is a lost cause, man.
Yeah.
Well, you had a lot of racism in your family?
My grandfather, my biological grandfather
yeah.
was wild racist.
Yeah.
And he, because of some family shit anyway, he probably hated me before I was born.
Yeah.
But when I started the fascination with rap, which is why you mentioned it and I was thinking about it, he like went out of his way to say like the most racist thing he could to
Ugh.
Me every time he saw me about my black friends
yeah.
or my black. And I didn't go see him when he was dying. I didn't go to his funeral. Like, he was a bad dude, but he would teach me shit. Like, he was I walked into a doctor's office with my mother.
Yeah.
As a little baby or toddler, there was a black family sitting in the doctor's office. I said, "Mom, porch monkeys." And my mother,
oh my gosh.
Because my grandfather had taught me
that
word.
Yeah.
yeah. And like thought it would be funny to teach a kid that. He was
right.
a bad dude.
Yeah,
he was like
that's terrible.
Yeah, he was like fringes of mob shit. And
it's an interesting thing with
yeah.
Italians, Italian Americans, because, you know, Italians want to talk about their plight coming over here. Like, oh, we were hated on as much as
yeah,
black
yeah.
people were. And I mean, I don't believe that to an extent whatsoever. But like my family, when they immigrated, they had 8 kids, right?
Yeah.
My grandmother was one of 8, and none of them were allowed to learn to speak Italian. And they're all dark skinned.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
if in California, people would think they were Mexican. You
yeah.
know what I mean? Like they're dark skinned like that. And within a generation, they had graduated to the social construct of white.
Yeah.
And even though I'm a third generation immigrant, like, you know, a lot of that side of my family is like very anti-immigrant
yeah,
and like
yeah,
don't let
sure.
people in the country. And
my,
I'm like, yo,
yeah.
we wouldn't be here.
I had this is like the conversation I keep having with my grandmother
yeah.
who came here with like $20 and worked in a sweatshop
yeah.
and is now anti-immigrant because
right.
she watches Fox News. And
right,
shit.
Exactly.
And yeah, it's wild, man. And there's so many similarities
mm-hmm.
too, because like if anyone should understand Black Lives Matter or the Black Panthers, it should be Italians, because
mm-hmm.
that's who the mob was.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
Italian people had no access to justice. So they just posse'd up
mm-hmm.
and tried to solve their own problems. You know, like there's,
right.
to me, that's the clearest line you could draw. And I'm like, how the fuck? You know, but it's just this weird, like, tribalism.
Totally.
Just tribalism.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
all it boils down to.
Yeah.
Yep. I have another question now that everything's been going on, like, you know, the Time's Up movement and the Me Too movement and stuff like that. And I think a lot of people are having shit dug up from their past. And I worry myself when I look back at songs of mine that maybe have misogynistic overtones or anything like that. I'm sorry, this is not like to blindside you guys, are fucking, I'm not going to be like, oh, I saw this tweet about this or whatever. My point is,
I wish you guys, would. You guys, I wish no, you would right now.
Do you guys have any songs that you look back on in your careers and be like, man, these days I wouldn't have wrote that? And I'm like, embarrassed, because I have so many songs that I'm like embarrassed of in my past, you know?
Yeah. I'm not devastatingly embarrassed, there's always lines like that are corny to me.
Totally.
I thought it was clever at the time. I was like, but those are 20, 25-year-old songs.
Right.
So,
but you have people that are finding out about them now who are like, yo, this is my favorite song. And I'm like, fuck, I hate that song. I wish you wouldn't listen to it.
Yeah.
That, you
know? I mean, The Rewrite is one of those songs that people always are surprised when I'm like, you know what? That song's not all that.
Right.
Because it's, yo, Rewrite saved my life, bro. And even girls would tell me that and be like, that song is like fucking incel rap. That shit is like, you know, like me trying to.
I just learned what incels are. That shit is so dark.
Trying to guilt trip this girl into getting back with me. And it was, you know, I should have just laid off.
Right.
But I made a song about it. I made a movement about it. I made a fucking career out of it.
Thanks.
So, you know, thanks to the song, I think a lot of good things did happen.
Yeah.
But if you identify so much with that song, you might need to check yourself, because I needed to check myself and change and grow as a human.
Yeah.
Knowledge dart.
That
bullets of truth.
That's exactly the kind of answer I was looking for, because, like, yeah, I'm going through that shit now where I'm like, oh, man, I wrote this song 15 years ago, and I'm like, and I'm just like, ugh, you know? And people are like, oh, I love that song.
Well, but what you, and the other thing I always have to recognize, because I don't let it bug me ever, because people are 14 years old.
Right.
People are 19. People just had their heart broken.
Yep.
So the music I made when I first got my heart broken, it makes sense to them even more than it does to me now. You know, so it's, I do perform those songs sometimes, but I like to make the announcement that I basically feel like I'm covering my own music.
Right.
Like, it's not even me. I don't share even the single cell that I had when I wrote that song. But I know you guys like it, and let's have fun at a show.
That's an interesting take. Yeah. You got anything like that you feel?
The only regret is a joint that was very confessional where I used people's real names.
Oh, shit.
On it was like my first release, and I didn't really understand fully the staying power or something like that.
Right.
And that I definitely regret that. I think about reissuing it with the shit
bleeped
edited
out or something.
Or something.
Right,
yeah. But thankfully I spent so many years in the lab that and I hate releasing things, so I don't have too many.
Which is something we have to get over. Like,
I'm getting.
Yeah, sometimes you just got to put it out.
But
you can't drag your feet too much longer.
That's why Young Dole is thankfully only lives in my hard drives that'll be burned when I die.
Well, let's talk about Old Dole then. Like, now that we are getting older, here's my question for you guys. Now that we are men of middle age and going into our more mature years of our life, have you guys felt the footsteps at all, like when you make music, of like, oh, I'm too old to be doing this, or like, oh, it's a young man's game? And I'm asking because I go through that constantly. And if you've ever felt that, how do you cope with it? And how do you just get past that and get past those footsteps, the yips?
I don't stress that shit too much.
I actually prefer the challenge of it.
Really?
I like that. I like the new level of, like, I haven't seen too many people do this the right way, and I look forward to doing it the
Aging
right
gracefully
way.
In rap is hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this could be the first generation to do it. You know? Yeah.
But part of why I wanted people to think I was old when I was young.
Yeah.
Because I made people think I was like 43 or whatever when I was
right.
Like,
that was the whole
early
thing.
20s.
No one knew Sage's real name or age.
Yeah. So I liked the idea that people already thought I was old.
Yeah.
So that I could continue to do things and not have to worry about a bump once I actually did hit 40.
Right.
Because then I'm like, people are like, how the fuck old are you now? You fucking 80 years old? Like, nah, I'm actually still the same age, homie.
Yeah, right. That's funny.
I mean, the age thing, it colors people's reception and understanding of it. But for me, like, you know, the end game is like just making more shit, and like this like musical journey, as cliche as that is, like, totally. I get off on like making the next shit and the ideas and putting them together. So as long as I'm still challenging myself and still doing shit I don't know how to do, and I'm into what I'm doing, that's the reward for me. So then when it goes out, it's like, oh, you know, my age
somehow, like we were just talking about this in the car. It's like, it's kind of funny now. A lot of cats have dropped out of the game, and now we're just like two people that, like, this kid came to the show in Dallas, and he was just like, young dude, green hair, like, and he was just like, yo, this is incredible. My friend brought me here. You both look like my friend's parents, but yo, you're fucking nasty. Like, yeah. You know, like, where the
it's
fuck
blowing
did these,
their mind.
These old right. ass dudes, why can they rap like this? You right. know, like, it's, you know, out of context yeah. for them. So that's funny. To
yeah,
the,
that's
like,
amazing.
You know, but that all has to do with their perception of what, you know, we've been doing. And
you guys got a way healthier outlook about it than I do. That's for sure.
My unhealthy outlook, though, is that I don't look forward to having to win over a younger fan base every 5 years.
Right.
In order, because our fans are so old now. Like, our original fans
yeah.
are married with kids
right.
and with a job, and they cannot come out on a Monday night in Los Angeles.
I feel like sometimes, though, they're like, they're getting older now. The kids are old.
Yeah, right now.
Yeah.
We're at the age where
they're
they actually
back.
Can start coming to yeah. shows.
Because it's like, oh, my kid's in junior high. Can babysit my younger ones
yeah.
now. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. I always think there are certain artists in the underground that, like, they have a new 18-year-old discovering them every month. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so I'm sure,
yeah.
like I think about, like, the Living Legends and Hieroglyphics
right.
and you guys, and it's like there's always some kid entering college and going through his real hip-hop phase
yeah.
where it's like you guys are always going to have perpetually young fans, huh?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, without maybe, a lot of work, I'm saying I just don't want to work for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I feel that.
I just want them to find me and be like, okay, you have a lot of music to catch up on.
Yeah.
We're still making music. You know, find the era that you like the most and
yeah.
don't expect me to continue to do that.
For someone that has, like, perpetuated this idea of being the eternal loner, how was it working with him on music as a partner? Was it easy or difficult?
We're both pretty
yeah.
like lone wolf
yeah.
category in the booth and in the process.
Yeah,
it wasn't. I had fun. I mean, I knew what it was going to be like ahead of time. It lived up to pretty much my expectations because there's like two people in my head that make a record. There's one that's like a little excited kid that just wants to like yeah the idea person, and then there's like this Nazi ass editor.
Mm-hmm.
And so like we went to the Fringe festival in Scotland. We shared an Airbnb for 30 days and we like started everything. Mm-hmm. And that shit was just fun. Like it was super fun to let, like, this is how in my mind it works, to let the kids play together.
Yeah,
to, like,
right.
to put a bunch of shit up on the wall. Like, yeah, this song, this hook, this fun, look at this beat, that'd be funny. And then, you know, then we get to the process of, like, making it,
mm-hmm.
which is where it became less fun. The editors for both of us stepped in, and they're both very rigid. And, you know, like, getting them to get along and all agree. Plus, you know, there was a workflow of beats between my studio at home, DS3K, the engineer I work with locally, who, like, beefs stuff up for me, and then Alias, who was mixing the record.
R.I.P. Alias. Sorry for
your
loss,
man.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. That was very, very sad.
Yeah, the worst. But yeah, so, I mean, it's been ups and downs. It's been like, even the tour has been wild emotional.
Yeah.
But, like, we have a lot of dope-ass songs.
Yeah,
so
we do.
Yeah.
When we make the songs, we mainly make solo music.
Yeah.
So, and I've done it for so long that switching gears and trying to do a group thing, because I finally get to go back and do the Run DMC that I always wanted to do. But we just joining forces and trying to figure out how to make that work out. It's really like I said it before, but I feel like I wish I could have been a fly on the wall in writing sessions for a Beastie Boys album and see who, like, how do you all have different lines? Like, who wrote that?
Yeah, right.
I mean,
I listen back on those. Yeah, as a kid, I was like, oh, this one is the best rapper of the group. But I'm like, oh, he was just saving the lines for himself that he wrote,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I would imagine it was one person writing on that, no?
And we've, to solve all these problems, because we both have, like, different references and points in the hip-hop timeline that we're trying to, like, hit. So in doing that, like, we definitely have experimented with, like, a bunch of different even writing methods.
Mm.
Like, writing methods where it's like, okay, you write 16, I write 16, and that's easy. All right, you write 8, I write 8. Or you write 16, I send it to you. You chop the shit out of it, send it back.
Right.
Like, it was, like, workflow shit like that. Even, like, mic sounds, audio, you know, like,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, totally.
But coming up with this song, ideas, what's funny, because when we tour, we've toured so much together, we've shared rooms together for so long. some of my favorite things is just the random ass ideas that pop up that a lot of people would laugh off and like, ha, yeah, imagine that happened. Like, nah, let's make this real. Mm-hmm. Like, this idea is so dumb that if we move forward with it, people are going to enjoy it just as much as we did in the moment where we just laughed.
Right.
Like, it's possible. I love that because there's stuff I can't do with Sage Francis. Mm-hmm. There's stuff I can do with Epic Beard Men.
Right.
I love having that opportunity, which just was not there. Because I could do, like, Zalzan stuff was its own, you know, nasty, pervert, old fuckface guy.
Yeah,
so that was okay for some of the weird parts of my brain. It was like, all right.
That's- it's interesting how when you are going through your process, like, you have to compartmentalize different songs into different things. Like, oh, this is a mixtape joint. This is an album joint. This is a Zalzan joint. This is a Sage Francis joint. Yep. You know, yeah.
So now I have a new category. I have a new option, a little new thing I can put ideas into that can grow into an actual song.
How would you guys say that Epic Beard Men music differs from your own respectable solo work?
It's just less deep, less personal, less heavy, but that's not exactly right. But
it's more fun.
Playful?
It's more playful. Yeah, it is more playful, more funky, more punchy too. Well, I wouldn't say because your music is punchy, but
definitely more funky, more funk and soul samples than either of us have ever messed with at any one time, I think.
Yeah.
How do you guys go about finding beats?
We just keep asking people to send us shit and we make our own beats.
Oh, you guys are making beats?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Do you guys want to talk about Alias Passing at all? I know you guys were working together. Like, if it's too personal, you don't have to. But I mean, if there's anything you guys want to say.
We should. I mean,
he's worth talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that, you know, growing up, that was his beats were everywhere in my life. You know what I mean? And you know, the records he put out on Anticon were fucking beautiful. And the group project, Deep Puddle Dynamics, was a huge record in my life, you know? So a lot of the work you guys did together is
amazing. My most popular songs were produced by Alias, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, Sea Lion, Escape Artist. I mean, those songs are top of the playlist, you know, most spins, pretty much.
Yeah.
But I met him in 98, so that was 20 years ago when I first met him at my radio station. He came up. And I went to Maine, him and like Soul were still living in Maine and we recorded a song together, and he was the only dude who was obviously nice to me.
Right.
Where everyone else, I wondered if they hated me or not.
Standoffish.
Yeah. And he was all welcoming and made me feel good, made me feel like I could be part of what they were doing. And he's consistently been like that pretty much, I think, for everybody that he's ever encountered. He's just like this care bear of a dude.
Right.
And super talented. And one thing that like bugged me eventually, because we toured together the Human Death Dance tour. So that's I made him rap on it because I loved, like, I wanted him to rap.
Right.
I think he was self-conscious about his rap because being around Anticon dudes long enough, you start to get very self-conscious of, am I rhyming too much? You know, or such, you know, they got all these rules and shit.
Right, right.
And, but yeah, I was like, yo, you have to rap this song. Fans want to see, you know, this shit. And he did, like, he fucking went with it. It was his last big tour.
Yeah.
And then, cause he went completely domesticated. He was married early on, but he had, his child and then another child, and they had a house in Portland, Maine, once they moved back from California.
Since they were 15 there.
Yeah. There was his high school sweetheart, man.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. And he was done touring at that point.
Yeah.
And we could like hardly get him even the last show we played in Portland like 2 months ago, I was like, yo, you want to get up on stage and, you know, do, he's like, nah, homie, I just want to be, you know, a spectator. I was like, I totally understand. Cause I want to be that too.
Right.
But you went, you know, and did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I met him in 2006, I guess, on the Human, the Death Dance tour. I did a couple dates and I was a fan of his music and we rode together in the car. We both knew the same Aphrodite's Child record that had these wild drums that we were both like bugged out about.
Right.
And we just started realizing like we both liked the same kind of rap and both wanted to make an updated Gravediggers record in 2006.
That's amazing.
So after I was done with my first record, he produced my whole second album. And that was really like my rap debut. Like he was the first, you know, he was the dude to believe in me as a rapper and like dedicate an album full of his best beats. And yeah, just working with him, he was the most egoless cat. Like, he, from start to finish, by, he was a little, sending me less stuff anyway, by whenever it was last that, well, we were talking about a follow-up for Fallen House, because the 10-year anniversary is coming up. So he had just started sending me more recently, but in the in-between time, I had produced my record Kill the Wolf, which came out in 2015. He drove down to Rhode Island just to, like, play some synths and mix the whole thing and, like, added additional, like, chops throughout and stuff, not giving a shit that it wasn't his beats.
Right.
And that cat gave me his whole list of samples of, like, records. If you ever see these, buy him. He gave me his whole break folder.
Oh, wow.
And was like, you know, that was in preparation for the follow-up we were getting ready to start on. He had sent me some beats.
He's a pretty integral part of Strange Famous Records.
Yeah, he mixed everything, man.
Yeah, he's got his hands in pretty much all of our records.
Yeah. And that seems like it's a... He's probably a man that covered so many tasks and so many positions for you guys. It's going to be someone that's impossible to ever, like, even think about replacing.
Yeah, it's
got to
be,
like,
different.
Going to have to be probably...
That was one thing I think we said the day we found out that he passed away, which was a total shock, and no one expected it. He just...
Yeah, he's 41 years old.
Yeah.
He's like, picking up his daughter from school and whatever and we found out, and I just was like, I was fucking devastated. I, like, cried all day.
Yeah
I was fucked up.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm still fucked up. Like, yeah. Slug called me to tell me, like, he found out right away, and then he called me. I woke, like, I was actually laying in bed, just my eyes open, early morning. And he was like, he told me, I just couldn't process what the fuck it meant.
I woke up hearing that conversation and, like, looked at my phone and saw the message from Jen, his wife, and said, like, hey, it's Jen, can you give me a call? And I was hearing his conversation with Slug, and I was
and
like,
you knew
oh,
that
fuck,
call
I knew, yeah, I knew.
That's miserable.
But we knew it was different from that point on. Yeah. It's different. Like, he was just like, how do we even do anything now? Like, I know we can do it. It's just going to be different.
Yeah. It just, his reaction was so important to me. You know, like, I say I don't think about the audience, but, like, there is a small audience I give a shit about, and he was one of them. You know, like
that's your brain trust.
Yeah, when I'm trying to kill shit, I'm still in shock about the idea that I'm never going to see him react, or I'm never going to get a new email from him with a new beat, or you know, like, that music is gone. You know, like, that potential is gone, and that's not even the saddest part. That's such bullshit compared to what his wife and kids have lost. You know, like, his young daughter is just starting to talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's horrible, man. Like, life has been heavy this year.
Yeah,
man.
They got the GoFundMe.
Oh yes, yeah.
So if you...
And they're close to their goal, but they haven't met their goal yet.
Nah, yeah, it's a $75,000 goal, which will cover, what, years maybe of the help they need and care for the kids and whatever else. So what is the name?
I don't know the exact link, but maybe
Brendan Whitney.
You guys can put up a link.
Yeah, I can find it. Like, but yeah, I would imagine if you Google search alias GoFundMe, it'll pop up. Guys.
Our Twitters and stuff.
Yeah. I'm really sorry for you guys' loss, man. That shit is terrible. I know what it's like to lose a friend. It's fucking horrible.
Yeah, it sucks.
So
there's a network of people around his family, though. I talked to Dose at the funeral, and there's lots of people that want to make sure that they're looked after. So currently, like, that's what's making it okay. Like, looking after his family, making sure, you know. But yeah, it's a huge loss for lots of people. That's a heavy note.
Yep.
That's heavy. I just wanted to let it sit for a second before moving on. But that brings me to, like, another, I guess, avenue of questions that I have about, like, having been making music and making friends for so long, do you ever take the time to, like, look back longingly about friendships you had in the past that maybe are not as solid anymore? Or have you been able to maintain good friendships with most of the people that you've worked with in the past? Because I already look back, like, my friends 10 years ago, like, a lot of them aren't, like, really in my life anymore. And I look back on that with, like, regret.
You
nearly
shouldn't.
Every day.
You
know?
Shouldn't, because that's life. It doesn't even matter what you do. That you will, in life, probably find one or two people you stay friends with and stay close with.
Yeah.
People splinter off. People's lives are so complex and complicated. Yeah. Like, to pretend like we can all stay tight is a myth. And the fact that you aren't tight anymore doesn't mean either of you fucked up.
Right.
You know? And I can still hopefully contact an old friend and it'd be just like when the last time we talked.
Yeah.
You know, if your friendship's tight enough. But the only fucking person I build with is B.
Yeah, right.
Like, I don't even have a friend outside of, like, my girlfriend.
Yeah.
That's who I talk to. B, I talk to. Everyone else is just, like, splinters of, like, tiny info and time.
Yeah.
And that's okay, you know.
Totally. That's great. That's very sagely advice. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, as performers, like, the tour thing is weird because, like, when you tour with someone, you feel like when that 1 month is over, you're like, you are my brother.
Right.
We are family.
Yeah.
Like, but then, yeah, people grow up out of that and people are in different places. And,
yeah, man.
But I still retain, like, a lot of friendships. I've worked with a lot of musicians in the past couple albums. Like,
yeah.
I feel like
B is much more social than I am.
I'm
so in awe of his ability to talk to various people and stay in touch with them. And
sativa, yeah,
that's what it is. That's what it is.
I am. I do. I look upon it. I'm like, that's a different type of person than I am.
Yeah.
You know, I respect that. That's cool.
I bet in your heart of hearts, you probably still feel like an introvert, though. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, same. Because people mistake me as very sociable because I could talk to anybody.
Yeah.
I just sat and talked to you guys for an hour, but I'm the same way. I go home and I cherish my alone time and I feel like I don't let anybody actually get to know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You feel that way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the old man shit. That's
Maybe it's because I also made so many enemies in my life that I don't want to make any more enemies. I'd rather just keep my two friends.
Yo, for real. Yeah. I feel like I spent my fucking 20s like carpet bombing anyone around me that disagreed. And now I spend every day of my 30s being like, yo, sorry, I was such a piece of shit in my 30s or my 20s. I swear I'm cool now. Like,
I don't know shit. You know.
It's different for me, too, as a label owner and all the people I've had to work with on a business level. And like some people expected more or like, you know, if I'm in a position where I could have helped someone but didn't, the way they look at me from that point on, it's like it does taint a lot of things.
Totally.
And I have to give hard no's sometimes or like I have to give a hard pass. Like, nope, that can't do that. I mean, you're my homie, but I'm sorry. I'm not going to do what you want me to do for you right now. That causes a lot of...
You sound like DJ Khaled.
What did he say?
He said, I can't do what you want me
to
do.
Can't do that. He's talking about eating pussy, though.
I'm sorry.
Oh. I can do that. I start from the toe.
It's an interesting dynamic that you have in the creative world, particularly as touring artists, where it's like, to an extent, making money with somebody is a way to maintain a friendship because, like, you have time for survival and for, you know, capitalistic ventures, but then also making money with people and it being a failure is also the thing that, like, kills all friendships.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like if you can maintain that delicate balance, then you could – I don't know. It's
And in the music industry, people have weird expectations.
Yeah, totally.
People are very self-centered.
Yeah.
I can say that because I'm a rapper.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Part and parcel,
you deal with narcissists, a higher level of – narcissism than maybe the average personality.
Totally. I mean, it's like total like histrionicism or whatever. Like it's just peacocking constantly and like, look at me.
So you do make sense. And that's why, not to go back to Alias, but that's why that cat was so special.
Because
you do every once in a while run into cats that are like
genuine and selfless. So
yeah,
that's
when you find
the producer
them,
gene.
Lock them down.
Yo, totally. Producers are some of the most tolerant people on the planet.
Right,
I don't know how Mark.
That's true.
I don't know how Equilibrium still
and
fucks
Kev,
with me after
Daddy
this.
Daddy Kev.
Yeah, Kev is
he's another
the same
one
way.
Of those cats. It's just like, wow, like a good person here.
Totally. Kev is one of the few people that's managed to like maintain being a good person and also being the most astute businessman.
Right.
And like being able to balance those two things because most people are only one or the other, you know. Anyway, hey, guys, I think we did what we came to do.
Yeah,
and I appreciate you guys sitting with me. This is really, really fucking cool. Where can the people find you online and where can they find the new record?
We're on the socials. Epic Beard Men on Twitter,
there
Facebook, Instagram.
Yeah.
Snapchat,
Venmo. We're not on Snapchat. Venmo is for sending money.
Fuck it. We're on strangefamous.com.
There you go.
Strange Famous Records, but also the epicbeardmen.com.
Okay.
Which hopefully will still be up and operational.
It's up.
Okay.
This is evergreen content. People might find this 5 years
That's
from
what
now.
I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
Epicbeardmen.com. Google Epic Beard.
You say it so confidently.
Google Epic Beard Men. You'll get taken to something that's not us.
Yeah.
Make sure Yeah.
Google YouTube.
That's why Strange Famous is a good spot.
It's oh, yeah. Good Strange Famous. StrangeFamous.com.
But also, individually, you guys can follow them on Twitter, at Sage Francis and at B Dolan.
SFR.
SFR. Oh, B Dolan SFR. That's right.
B Dolan SFR.
Okay. There you go. Yeah, guys, thank you so much.
My
name
you,
is yeah, my name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition. You can follow me at It's Intuition. Follow my man, Ben Shim, behind the boards, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database. Follow us as a unit at Kinda Neat, YouTube.com/Kinda Neat, where you are going to see the Epic Beardmen perform
Five Hearts.
Five Hearts.
Yeah.
And Instagram at Kinda Neat, where you're going to see a picture of the three of us looking like long lost cousins. And yeah, that's it, man. Thank you guys. My name is Lee. That was Epic Beardmen, and this was Kinda Neat.